Moscow. Are you going to start in with this now? Mm-hmm. There are various stories about how Moscow got its name. But I think for once and for all, we ought to settle that. And there were stories that there were some Russian settlers over here at an early day, that a Russian duke came over and went hunting on Moscow Mountain, that there was a fellow who had a cow here, and he died, and there was some dispute about it, and his widow got the cow, and this cow was always bawling, and they'd say, well, what's all the noise? And that's Moe's cow. And that's how it got a name. Now, it's all perfectly silly because the facts have been well established, and the facts are that there was a early day settler from Pennsylvania that owned the store out at Parabas Valley, Sam Neff. Now, when the petition was sent in to create a post office in Moscow, about that time he sold his store to Llewellyn and moved, the store was moved west into Moscow, what is now Moscow. And the original petition for the creation of the post office, a copy of which I personally secured from the National Archives when I was back in Washington, shows that the petition was originally Paradise Valley, but that's been stricken out and the word Moscow substituted. Now, it seems that Neff, who was a very well-educated man, a scholar and teacher, came from a little town in Pennsylvania called Moscow. I looked it up in the Atlas today, and it has a population of 1,212 people even now. Now, Neff was very influential here. He thought this valley looked something like his valley where his little hometown in Moscow, Pennsylvania was situated. And he insisted that it be a good name to name it Moscow after his hometown in Pennsylvania. Nobody was going to make any objection, and the change was made. Now, this was substantiated later when, of course, Neff left here, but died later, 90 years old or something like that. But he had a son who lived over at... Tacoma, or no, over at Yakima. And back in 1961, the Latah County Pioneer Association got this son to come over here to Moscow, and the businessmen of Moscow contributed the money to pay his fare over here. He met with the Pioneer Association, and this was all discussed with him. And this son of Neff said that he had often talked it over with his father, and his father told him that this was the true story of how Moscow was named. Now, that has been accepted by everyone who has really made any study of it. I'll refer to Homer David in his very interesting reminiscences. He discusses this. He talked to Neff's son. He didn't know the original Neff personally. But he said there's no question that's how Moscow got its name. And that's corroborated by a letter that I received from Nan Smith, Theodora V. Smith, who was long the secretary of the Moscow of the Latah County Pioneer Association. I have the letter here. I preserved it. It was received by me back in Washington. She told about this, and she prepared an article which was given to the Chamber of Commerce. But there is no question that those who have studied it all, the best evidence is certainly that Moscow was named after this little town in Pennsylvania. I found when I was in the post office department that there are, I think, 11 Moscows in the United States, of which Moscow, Idaho, is by far the largest. But I think for that ought to forever be set aside the various stories about the naming of Moscow. It's just was a matter of fact uh, situation that took place here in the early days. Now, I first came to Moscow in 1911. I was then a boy over in Colfax. I came up with my parents on a special train to hear former President Theodore Roosevelt speak on a platform of wheat sacks built in front of the present administration building. It was then the very new administration building. I remember the tremendous crowd that was here. I remember what an interesting speech was made by former President Theodore Roosevelt. I remember I stayed behind to watch the cadets put on a drill after the speaking was over and managed somehow to get separated from my parents. They waited down at the train, the special train on the OWRN that was to take it to Colfax, and I finally made my way down there through the crowd, arrived at the train to the great relief of my parents, because my father would have stayed to look for me, but I got there on time and got back to Colfax. Now,
may I ask you, sir, what your impression of Roosevelt was that day?
Oh, a tremendously favorable impression. Roosevelt had been president. He was back from his hunting trip to Africa. He was a very interesting speaker. He had the crowd with him. You could understand why Roosevelt the Great, as I call him, was such a popular figure, because of course he'd been a rough rider. He'd lived out west as a rancher. He'd been a puny boy in his youth, but had regained it by his active physical activities. And no man to my knowledge in public life ever so captured the imagination and affection of the American people as did Theodore Roosevelt. Now, my parents were part of a pioneer family. My father had come as a small boy. His father had come west to California, then had come north by wagon, first into Oregon, then up to Dayton, Washington. And he was that's my grandfather, William Goff, was a harness maker. And he had a harness shop with another man at Dayton for two or three years. And he used to come up in the Palouse country by horseback looking around for a good place for a homestead. He finally settled on a place not so far from the old Mullen Road between Spangle and Waverly, and the family settled and homesteaded there. He had several brothers, and my father, when he was 12 years old, kept a diary. I have that original diary now. He told about the life in the pioneer cabin, about the Indians, about chinking up the cabin, how the snow sifted through in the storms, how they of course had no fruit. They grew lots of turnips, and because there was an idea of the pioneers that turnips would take the place of fruit, and there was no harvesting equipment then. They planted some wheat, but of course it was all cut with a scythe, and the way they harvested it, they either walked horses over it, or they tramped it down themselves. Then they'd throw it up in the air and let the chaff blow away. There was some very clever settlers down toward Dayton and off down that way who figured out an idea of building a platform and carrying the smashed down wheat heads up on this platform, and where the wind would blow and they'd drop it to harvest. Now, in those days, there was no mill around. There was a mill at Pine City. There was a mill at Colfax. There was a mill down at Walla Walla. But their wheat had to be taken to one of these mills and ground up. And the modern harvest equipment, that is, when I say modern, it's a mechanical harvesting by the harvester, didn't come in until the railroads came in the 1880s. And that's when they first got the mill started up. And of course, a lot of it was all done by teams, and that is of horses or mules. In those days, there was no regular RFD service. There was a few post offices. There was an early one at Roselia. The first one in this area was down at Lewiston. Then they started the one in Moscow. The mail was brought up by horseback. And when one of those settlers found some of his neighbors were going to town, they'd asked him to bring his mail. And remember that it could easily be brought by horseback because there was no junk mail then. There was no magazines. There was only an occasional newspaper. And the post offices were few and far between. Now, my other grandfather, for whom I'm named, Abe, he had walked, he'd been born in Illinois. He'd, with 17 other young fellows, in 1860, they walked from Illinois to the Pikes Peak Mines in Colorado, over 600 miles, and he mined for a while, then got into herding cattle. He was there during the Indian uprising of the Plains Indians in the late 60s. And in the 70s, by that time he'd gotten married, he embarked with his family in a wagon and an ox team to come to the Northwest. And they went up through Utah and Wyoming. Then he's somewhat interested in mining. They got up into Montana to mines. Then they followed the old Mullen Road from Montana into the Palouse country, and he homesteaded up near Roselia. Now my father was here early enough that he located a homestead himself over near the Hole in the Ground, what's known the Hole in the Ground, west of Roselia, which was the haunt of a band of horse and cattle thieves, and they'd been using this 160 acres for pasture, and it scared away any settlers from taking it up, but my father wasn't easily scared. He settled there and started his homestead. They warned him away. He was shot through the shoulder one time out at the homestead, made it back to the cabin, and he managed to fight them off, and what would have been my oldest brother was a baby then. The fire went out, and in all the excitement and the cold, the baby contracted pneumonia and died. Well, that was the tough life then in the early days. My father, to finish the story, this was in 1890, he went into Roselia, and when he got in, he was warned that a gunman was there, had warned him away from Roselia and was going to shoot him on sight, but my father wasn't scared again. He went on into Roselia, and over by where the Northern Pacific Depot is now, they met on the street and shot it out, and in true Western fashion, except that my father shot this fellow Hart through the body, and Hart eventually died. My father gave himself up to the town marshal. He was arrested for shooting Hart through the body, so he was like to die, and was taken to Colfax, but was released on bond, and after an investigation by the prosecuting attorney, Robert McCroskey, who later became Superior Court judge there, the case was dismissed on the ground that he had fired in self-defense. Well, my father was a prominent businessman over at Colfax. I grew up there, was there in 1910 when the big flood came on. And as I said, I came up with then to Moscow the first time. Now, my first sight of Moscow was, it was largely orchards around Moscow, apple orchards, beautiful apple orchards around Moscow, on all sides. And Moscow back in those days had sent a carload of apples up to the Interstate Fair at Spokane that won first prize. This was quite a place for apples down here. But later the farmers turned to wheat, and then there was the development of the Idaho harvester that was built here in Moscow. and this turned to wheat. There was a large brewery here run by old man Francel. But when Prohibition came along, this was turned over into a vinegar works, and originally started by Fred Veach. It was taken over by J.W. Gilmore, who recently died, and Joe Gilmore developed the vinegar works, which was operated here for years in the old brewery. I happened, when I first came into practice of law, to have been Joe Gilmore's attorney and incorporated his company, the J.W. Gilmore Vinegar Works, and also we incorporated the Northwest Vinegar Association, which was a cooperative association of vinegar works, vinegar manufacturers here in the Northwest. Now, to go back to my other experience in Moscow, I came here next in 1918. I had just graduated from high school that spring, taken care of some high school debts and so on, worked through the summer, but in the late summer I went up to Spokane and enlisted in the Army. Now, World War I was going on. I'd tried to get in before that. I hadn't tried to, but I wanted to, but I'd promised my mother. I already had a brother, my oldest brother Arthur was already in the Army, and she begged me to hold off until I graduated from high school, which I did. Well, I went up to Spokane and to enlist and got all lined up and was assigned to the 13th Division at Fort Lewis. The 91st Division, the training of the 91st Division had been completed, and they had gone to France, and they were forming this new division. Well, I went back home to await word of when I was to go, and then I received word that it's all been changed, that I had been selected because I was a high school graduate and was a prospect for an Army commission, that I was going to be sent to the University of Idaho for preliminary training. And I was sent and did report at Moscow on October 1st, I was here a little earlier than October 1st, 1918. Then I was finally sworn in. And here at that time, there was a smaller group of those who were high school graduates who were here for training in regular academic courses. And then there was a large group, 600 or 800 or more, of Section B that were here for training in mechanics, and mechanics and repair of tanks and things of that kind. And there was some barracks built up to the university. There's still some remnants up there in the old wooden buildings that are there on the campus. The one that I lived in was a set of barracks built just west of the administration building, where there's a parking lot now, and I lived there. We lived in Comfrey Barracks. We went to classes usually in the morning and then drilled in the afternoon. And in late October, there was a notice posted that I'd been selected, one of 12 selected, to go to the 4th Infantry Officers Training Camp at Camp Travis, Texas. But about that time, we were in the height of the flu epidemic. Now, these people that weren't alive here in Moscow and in the United States during the great influenza epidemic that started in about March 1918 and continued through October 1918, really can't understand what a terrific tragedy it was for the nation and, in fact, for the whole world. Because in the United States, there were 20 million people contracted influenza. It was a very serious disease. It started as a cold. They went to bed. They had a high fever, went to bed. And most of the casualties came when they thought they were better and got up and went out. And they'd often die within a day or two after they went out, because they didn't realize that long bed confinement was necessary before it was safe to go out in the cold. Well, that was a terrible thing here, and In Moscow, they had soup kitchens. Every place was pressed into service for the hospitals. There was the old Gritman Hospital, and then there was the other hospital that was downtown that was operated. Buildings were taken over for hospitals, put in any place. And, of course, the troops had been moving, and troops were taken off trains and died all the way along. They canceled the orders for this group of ours to go to Camp Travis, Texas. And then the armistice came along on November 11th, and everything was called off. And we stayed on here. We were finally discharged. I was finally discharged from the Army on December 21st. Well, I went home, and here I was. I'd got a little bit of a start, but a peculiar kind of a start at the university. But I liked Moscow and liked the university, so I decided that I'd come back. We were on a quarter system then. So I decided to come back to the University of Idaho, although I had two brothers who went to Washington State College and had played on the football team there. And there is every reason that I would have gone to Washington State. But I decided to come back to Moscow, to the university, and I did come back and enroll in January 1919. And stayed on in here at the university for most of 6 years, although 1 year I had to lay out part of the year because I ran out of money. But I finally graduated from the law school in June of 1924. I worked at most everything, but we won't go into that. But Although I might mention that in those days there was no grants and aid for football players, and if you were a widow made the team, you did get preference on a hashing job or a janitor job. And so I actually became the head waiter over to what was then Lindley Hall. Now, Lindley Hall was built when I was in law school. And the university was in terrific need of housing. And the Moscow Chamber of Commerce took it up, and a lot of public-spirited citizens got together, and they raised enough money in Moscow to build, by the sale of bonds, to build a dormitory. And President Lindley, Ernest K. Lindley, had just resigned here to go back as president of Miami University. He was very popular here, so they insisted that the new dormitory be named Lindley Hall. It was called Lindley Hall. It was built in 1923. I worked on Lindley Hall carrying hod. That means I had a hod on my shoulder. I carried mortar and brick up to the masons. And at the same time, I worked there from 8 in the morning till 5 at night and was batching. And then I started in at 7 and worked wheeling concrete on building the big tall elevators we have down here that was being built by the Mark P. Miller Elevator Company, Mark P. Miller Milling Company. I worked from 7 to 12, half of a 10-hour shift. Then I would go home, get myself something to eat, go to bed, and catch myself getting up again to go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. Well,
going to school.
I was going to school and going
time?
To I was going to law school then. And then, of course, during that year, in my final year in college, I played football, and my last year in 1923, I had two other jobs. I had a hashing job, and then I had they decided to separate the law library from the general library and have a student librarian, so I got the job through the kindness of the dean as the student law librarian, part-time student law librarian, and I worked every evening from 7 to 9 in the evening in the library, that is, was there, and then, of course, I was there during the day, but the law school was small, and books weren't taken out, and there wasn't the supervision that's necessary now.
You did your law school?
Oh, I had. Why, sure. I studied my law work at at during those 7 to 9 hours that I was at night when I was there in charge of the law library. And then also I was very fortunate that I they had to have a guard over at the old gymnasium, which was the armory. They had a lot of guns and other military equipment there, and somebody broke in and stole some of the rifles, and they decided they had to have somebody there as a guard at night. So they fixed up a little cubby hole in there, about 12 by 12 with a bed in it. And you see, I got a free room for sleeping there at night. So that took care of my place to stay.
Would you say many people were in the same boat as
needing to
work?
Oh, yes. There was few loans then, and there was no aid outside, and we just had to make it. And, of course, also, on top of that, I was a lay reader in the Episcopal Church, and there was no minister over at Colfax, and the bishop in Spokane finally turned over the charge of this mission to me, and I would go down there every Sunday and take charge of the church and read the service. On Sundays, go down on the gasoline bug from on Sunday mornings to Colfax, and then come back in the afternoon after I'd conducted the service. And I got the handsome sum of $10 a Sunday plus my railroad fare for going over and doing that. Well, anyway, I graduated from the university in June of 1924.
Before we go on with what happened after that, I'd like to know a little bit about the football. You told me it was good times for football for the university when you were there.
Well, I was fortunate to have been in what I think probably, in spite of what a lot of people have talked about winning teams, I happened to be there when Idaho was taken into the Pacific Coast Conference. And at that time, it included all the large Western universities, Washington, Oregon State, Stanford, the University of California. The University of Southern California was admitted at about the same time as the University of Idaho. It was had been a church school, and we used to make fun of it and call it the Southern Branch it was more or less in its inception as far as athletics were concerned. Also, of course, in the Northwest, there was Washington State College, then Washington State College, the University of Montana, and the University of Idaho. Well, then, all of these colleges were relatively small in comparison to what they are now. Idaho was and Montana were the smallest, but still, we could hold our own pretty well then. There were none of these grants and aid. There was football players, yes, sought out and came, but there was none of the going out and like they do now and hauling in them and giving them scholarships and the various things of that kind. There was not the money in it. There was not even radio then in those days, and no television, not the big money. Idaho, under Coach Matthews, more than held its own with any of the Pacific Coast Conference teams. We played them all in my last year. In 1933, we went undefeated and unscored on here in the Northwest and went down to California to play Stanford, which was then they had their great All-American and Hall of Famer Ernie Nevers. We suffered our first defeat against Stanford and then went on and played Southern California. We were pretty badly battered up at Stanford, and we lost to also 14-9 to the University of Southern California. But you see, it was a different picture in athletics then. In those days, Whitman was quite a power. Gonzaga was a real power in those days. They had some very strong teams. In fact, in 1923 or 24, we had beaten Gonzaga 14-0 here in Moscow. And by the way, we beat Washington State 14-0 that year. we used to play at Boise. That year we beat Oregon State 6-0 in Boise. But we had played University of Washington the year before, and they luckily beat us 2-0, and they wouldn't play us for 5 years. Those days, they didn't make up their schedules till each year. They didn't make them in advance. Washington wouldn't play Idaho. They, there was quite a, it used to be a, quite a joke around, well, University of Washington won't play Idaho. They came through with that win of 2-0, and they wouldn't play us. They didn't play Idaho again for 5 years. We would have beaten them badly in 23 or 24, I'm sure. We didn't have any, well, we had trouble because it was even match. But in the next year, Idaho would have gone to the Rose Bowl, except that they were beaten by Stanford under Pop Warner and with Ernie Nevers over at Portland 3-0. But those days won't come again, and we can't expect it to come again because it was an entirely a different era. The schools were different. The money involved was entirely different. Football then was more of a 6 years, and of course you had to be chairman of it, and Mabel was one of the greatest helpers. Well, they sent the our names in, and they met some men come from Washington, D.C. to see our project, and in the meantime, Mr. Onstott right down here was our technician for the soil conservation, and Mabel and his wife got together, and they had a chicken dinner up on our old farm that we used to call the old farm, but what we'd fixed it up. Well, you couldn't believe that we were sitting there with the guys from Washington, D.C. out on an old farm, and all the technicians come from all around in this close central Idaho, and we had an awful deal. And we'd be at ponds and seed waterways and fixed, you know, cleared out brush patches and fixed up a farm. Well,
was this the farm that you bought?
Yeah.
Same one?
Same one we got now, and was tickled to death to get it, you know, and show it. And, you know, some of these times I'd just like to show you. No farm lays any better than it did in the country, and you can get up on one little knoll pipe, and there's 360, and that's 300 of farmland, and you can just about see every corner from that one little place. And fellas has come and looked at it and said, if you'd have told me this, I'd never believed it till you showed it to me, and so we just think a world of it. But
well, this point, is this where the house is at, or is
no,
that's
you have to go up on a little knoll from the house. House is built in a nice kind of level place, pretty much. The farm is none of it steep. It's an awful good farm that way, and it's not too flat, and it's not too hilly, and we just think the world of it, and people come and look at it and say, see, we was hailed out this year. We got in the hailstorm. We didn't harvest nothing. And we had some insurance on it. And the old fellow was there. We just finished up signing the last papers to get some money. And here, 10 days or 2 weeks, and I was just telling Mabel, well, every time I see the mail come, I think we should have some money. And so, but that we haven't got any, but we'll come. But yeah. But we had done very well in the last few years. We skimped and saved, and we had a pretty good little patch of money saved up on the farm, paid for and everything. So we started out with nothing. The first thing, she had a few head of cows when she got married. It was like when she was a kid, you know, they'd give her a calf or something. Well, we had a team, and that's what we started with. And then me and my dad had it. Got a little old crawler tractor. Well, he'd farm over here, and I'd take it over there and farm to get started, you know. But we had several horses, and when we lived over here, we raised horses and sold horses. We had some fine Belgians, so I had some of them I could use anytime I wanted. So we're there, see. But we didn't have no barn or nothing for stock over there. The fella had the place before we did. He lived over there close, and he didn't have nothing. Only an old wheel tractor, and he never did raise much.
And the fence rows was all brush and stuff, and we worked that all out years in the 30s. Didn't make no difference when you had much money, but we had plenty to live on, and I'd just work at stuff like that, you know.
Improving the farm?
Improving the farm and stuff, and yeah, you know, sometime I'll take you up and we'll see it. And what I think is, I call it grubbed out of nothing, pretty much. But it's a pretty good place. I got the finest fall wheat in the country this year. And the hail came and ruined all of our grain crops. But I didn't plant any peas. I don't know why I didn't plant peas. I usually plant some, but if I'd had them planted, I'd have lost them too. But I had this for summer policy, so I tiled some of it, and that's why I left it summer policy, so I could tile some of it and some draws. And
when you say tile, what's that now?
Well, you put tile in the ground, but if you've got a wet place over here, you know, that is slow about farming. It's a 4-inch plastic pipe, and you'll dig a trench down and lay that down about this deep, you know, and that'll drain that water out so you won't have a mud hole there in the summer. And I tiled some of that, and they have a machine to dig this with that just goes like this and digs it down, and there's an auger here, and it augers it out each way, and it'll dig a ditch this deep just putting there as fast as you can walk. Well, then when you this tile just falls right in there, and then you push the dirt back over it. But this tile has got creases in it and little holes, and the water can go in at any place. And if it's got a slope, it'll drain out, you know, so you won't have a mud hole up in your field. Some of the fields, a lot of times we have a lot of snow, and you know that snow would hang on them low places a long time, and then that'd be mud to the way up when you'd like to be a farmer. Well, this way it helps green it out so that you can farm better.
Well, when you first got that place, you didn't have no idea how long you'd be there, did you?
Oh, no. Uh-huh. Never did have a lease on it till we bought it. The old man, I said something to about him about a lease, but my dad and we'd growed up on his farm over there, and I asked him about a lease, and well, he said, I tell you, I always figured if your word wasn't no good, your signature wasn't no good. And I went by that as a motto all the rest of my days. I thought if he thought that, and I've just tried to live like that. And yeah, a wonderful old man he was.
What kind of terms did you have for living on that place in those days? What was the kind of
a third of the crop
was his?
Yeah, third rent. That's what all of it used to be. Practically went by a third. You know?
All the renters paid that.
Yeah, that was the going rent. A third of the crop. Of course, he had to pay the taxes and. And he usually paid for fixing the fences and stuff. That is, he furnished the stuff, but you done the work. And
But you went and built a house on it anyway.
Yeah, he furnished the lumber.
I see.
And it is poor grade of lumber in them days. But since then, we've put slate siding on the house and. And we got, it's a metal roof house, we got, because there's lots of snow up there, and that metal always slid off, you know, and it didn't bother.
Well, come and eat, save the tape a while.
Come on. It drifted the snow just as high as the drill was out in the field, and that's after he had his seeding gun.
Really?
Yeah. Now they had their cattle in the canyon, and the sunflowers was all in bloom and everything, and they had it drifted so in the canyon they had to go and to have a time of getting them cattle out, they had to dig some of these drifts so the cows could get out to get home to get something to eat.
Oh, I can't. That's hard to believe to have that happen. Yeah. This was right through the end of March. It was like that? The year she was born.
Yeah, old Wade Keene, he lived on American Ridge, and he come to town, and he said, I'll bet there's 5,000 songbirds dead along the road. It froze to death from up there coming into town. Hell, it got down to over 20-some below zero all in just once.
Did it snow, too, or what happened? Mm-hmm. Just...
Like a blizzard.
Yeah. Hey, Roy, what was your date of birth?
The Moscow Hotel was the center of everything then. And, of course, then there was Judge Hodgins in the Hodgins Drugstore. Hodgins had been one of the early settlers, very early settlers in the 70s. As a boy, he grew up over by Genesee. Was the first probate judge of the county when Latah County was formed by an act of Congress. And by the way, as you know, this is about, I guess, the only county in the United States was created by an act of Congress. The First National Bank was there on the corner. It was a three-story building, and up above was a lodge hall. Of course, that's been torn down. Across the street, as I remember it, there was a barn over there, back of the First National Bank, was the Carl Grice had his undertaking establishment. As I remember it, the First Trust and Savings Bank was up the street a little ways, but after I started to practice law, they built the fine building that the First Security Bank is now lodged in now. The other bank, across where the abstract office and where there's a women's shop there in that building, was the Moscow State Bank. It was operated by Robert Whittier as president and Harry Whittier as cashier. They were very fine and active people here, businessmen here. That went down in the Depression in 1933. Of course, Chris Hagen, and Hagen and Cushing had a big meat market and grocery store next to Creighton's store. And of course, Hagen and Cushing had a packing plant out east of town, out in the area where they now have the baseball park and field out there, soccer field out there. Creighton's was operating. Vic Ramstedt was a younger man then, now gone. His son now operates it, the business. And going a little further up the street was the Pastime Pool Hall. Now, the Pastime Pool Hall was the poor man's club. It was a fairly large establishment on one floor, the ground floor. They had a lunch counter, a big one. They had the people go in there and play cards. They could buy soft drinks and coffee there. But the Pastime Pool Hall stayed open, never closed. It was open day and night. There's a big stove in there. Anybody could go in there. In the winter time, anybody that was cold could go in there. I remember there was one character called Old Posey who lived in a shack down on the north end of town here. He used to go in there. He was a kind of a half-witted fella. He'd come in there, and Art Ransom ran and owned the Pastime Pool Hall, and he lived up in a nice bungalow house up across east or west of the old courthouse. Ransom was a very interesting man. A very quiet, very, he never got excited. He was always in the background. But as a prosecuting attorney, I can say that there was never a better running established than that we had there. And in all the years I was prosecuting attorney, we never had any offenses committed there, never had any trouble with liquor. He kept it in perfect order, never had any trouble with gambling. Hunters used to go in there, they would go hunting and get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You could always go in and get a good meal there if you came in the middle of the night. And even college students, of course, no girl or woman would ever go in there because that was simply strictly the domain of the men. But they used to send somebody in to get hamburgers and so on. And really, it was an asset to the town. He didn't sell any magazines. I can say that it was the poor man's friend. And the lumberjack that came in, I can remember it was a standing joke that when the first snow fell and a lumberjack could walk out in front and the snow would be coming down and somebody would say to him, "Now, aren't you sorry that you didn't hang on to your summer wages?" But they could always go into the pastime. There were some benches there, and of course he did a good business. There was pool tables there. It was frowned on by the very churchy part of the town, but actually it was the best run establishment of its sort that I've ever known. And of course it passed when Art Ransom passed, because somehow he could get along with everybody and he operated it there. Then, of course, further on down and across the street was what had been the old department store, the great big, what's now the Thetuna Apartments. That had gone out, and there was stores in there, and then, of course, they remodeled it in my early days here in Moscow, that is, when I was practicing law, into the Thetuna Apartments. But that had been a great department store in the early days that attracted a lot of business to Moscow. And of course, further on down the street, on the east side of Main Street, was the Washburn Wilson Seed Company office. And then, of course, over toward the railroad were their warehouses and so on. And of course, to go back on the east side of Main Street, and I'm passing out a lot of places I know. Well, of course, I should mention that there's the closed harvester plant down there where the early football games had been played. And on the east side of the street, of course, besides the what became the Thetuna Apartments, was the Fred Sam's furniture store, the Elks Lodge, the old Idaho Hotel, and then later they built the Moscow Grange building there in that area. And of course, coming up further uptown was the Willis Drugstore. There was the Moscow State Bank, the Abstract Office, there was Robbins Pool Hall in there that was run by one of the Robbins brothers. There was another, Grant Robbins, who was a chief of police and a fine officer. Bill Robbins ran the pool hall. And then there was Charlie Bowles, the corner drugstore. Charlie was a well-known pioneer druggist. Across the street, but of course, was the David's department store. Frank David was still alive with his four sons, Homer, Howard, Earl, and Don, but Don had graduated in 1917 and gone back to Harvard, where later he became dean at the Harvard Business School. I should mention that on 3rd Street was the, further on down, was the old Pleasant Home boarding house, the Grice Undertaking Parlor. There was the old business college was up above, oh, for a minute I can't think of his name, was up above where the jewelry store and sheep shop is now. Oh, I'll think of his name later. Across the street was Jerry's cigar store, where he sold peanuts and hot popcorn.
And Jerry had started with a peanut and popcorn stand there on 3rd Street, and finally it was a portable one that used to be rolled up on wheels, and then he got his little Jerry's store there. And across the street was the old grocery store. I can't remember the name of the grocery store. Opposite it was the Table Supply, a local grocery store. Herman Wilson had operated the store on the side where Jerry's on the north side, but he got into the Washburn Wilson Seed Company, and a fellow by the name of Davis took it over. And this Davis was a very unusual fellow. He had his boys there, and Davis did fairly well with the store, and then he went to Florida. And he proved to be a very unusual executive. He built up what is now the Winn-Dixie Stores Incorporated, which covers all of Texas. It's the leading mercantile grocery and food supply chain in Florida. His sons have become vice presidents, and one of them, a graduate of the University of Idaho that used to clerk in the store part-time, is now one of the vice presidents. A very fine young fellow that Colfax, that I knew his family well from over there. His name is Hollingsworth, Howard Hollingsworth. He's become a real executive now and a vice president of the Dixie Wynn Stores, and he started as working part-time in Davis's store. Now, further on up, of course, Ken Worthy had his theater there, his first theater next to that. And back of that was the Frost had a garage. And later that was burned down, and then George Bluer had a garage there. And of course then there was the post office. And across the street from the post office, I've kind of forgotten what some of the, there didn't seem to be much of a house or two there. And then there was the Egan Hall, there where the Market Time drugstore is. That was the main meeting place for dances and general community meetings were there. And then further up was the old DAR Hall, but the DAR Hall had burned down. Not the DAR, I mean the GAR, the Grand Army of Republic Hall, had burned down before I came to Moscow, but that was pointed out where it was. And just at the corner there, across from where the parking lot by the Methodist Church is, was the George Lamphere lived there. Now, George Lamphere was a very interesting man. George Lamphere had run the weekly Idaho Post, and then he consolidated with the Star Mirror and had the Star Mirror. And then later there developed this big fight between Frank B. Robinson's newspaper and the Star Mirror that resulted after Lamphere's death in the merger of the two in what is now the Idahonian, but that was the merger of the News Review and the Moscow Star Mirror. But that's a long story about that. I was involved in that when Dr. Frank B. Robinson had his Psychiana, which was deserves a story all its own. Now, the lawyers, when I started to practice, I should mention that down the street, Charlie Carter had just started his, he had the Carter's drugstore. He started that in about the same time that I started to practice law. And next to him was the Parisian, which is operated by Stewart. We called him Fanny Stewart. Gee, Stewart had some wonderful women's clothing there. He used to go back to New York each year and get it. Then the City Hall was next to that. Then across the street was R.B. Ward's Hardware and Paint Store. further on down, there are other buildings, Penny's. There was a service station down in the next block. I've just tried to hit some of the leading businessmen we had here at the time. I ought to mention Hawk and Melgard and Bill Cahill at the First Trust and Savings Bank, Claude Renfrew and John Heckathorn at the First National Bank of Moscow, which was then an independent bank. Chris Hagan, of course, was an early senator from this county. Fred Veach was a prominent real estate and businessman whose business was eventually taken over by Martin Mickey. There was George Richardson, who later became mayor of Moscow, who was the station agent for the Spokane and Inland Railway when it came in 1908, and that later was taken over by the Great Northern Railway. There was Oscar Bonnet, who came out from Kansas and was with the Washburn Wilson Seed Company, who later became a wonderfully fine man, whose son was Robert Bonnet, who has carried on the fine tradition of his father for public service. A wonderful family, Oscar Bonnet and his son Robert Bonnet. There was Tim Sullivan, who ran the Foreign Garage and was one of the directors of the Moscow State Bank. He was the early Ford dealer here and a leading citizen. I've spoken about Joe Gilmore, who operated the Vinegar Works. And of course, there was Gub Mix, who became Lieutenant Governor, who was active in politics, who was a prominent graduate of the university. And there was his brother, Frank Mix, who lived out north of town, who took over the old Frank Barton house that later, after Mix died, was taken over by the man who ran the creamery here. Stop it for me. It was taken over by Corter later. Of course, Corter is now passed, and the what used this to be the old Moscow Creamery is now where the City Hall is. Now, I want to mention, of course, that Moscow's probably most prominent citizen in the state Jerome J. Day, the mining man, who had his palatial home here in Moscow, but he also had a home in Wallace, and he was a member of the famous Day family, that was a wealthy mining man, and he was a regent in the university and a graduate of the university. I think some of the old timers will remember Charlie Thompson, who used to run the old abstract office. And then there was Fred McGowan, who worked for him, an interesting old bachelor who was bald-headed and his head came up to a point. But those were some of the old-timers in business when I came in here. Now the lawyers, when I came in, I was the youngest lawyer. There was all old-time lawyers when I came in. I got a chance to go in the office of C.J. Orland, who was an old-time lawyer here. His partner, William E. Lee, who had been a prominent lawyer, had just been elected to the Supreme Court of the state of Idaho. And Lee had left his office vacant there. And at the suggestion of Bill Lee, whom I knew, I went in and saw Mr. Orland, told him I wanted to practice law, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you, Abe, I'll let you come in here. You can have Lee's old office. I'll let you use my library. And you can pay me $10 a month rent." And that's how it started out. Then later, when Orland, as a compromise, with several aspirants, was appointed prosecuting attorney, on the death of the man who had been elected in prosecuting attorney, Orland was appointed, and he'd take the job only in case he had a deputy to do the running around, and I was appointed the deputy. And then I served for nearly 2 years as his deputy, and then I ran for prosecuting attorney and was elected for 4 terms myself. Now, the attorneys, the leading attorneys here in Moscow at that time, were August H. Oversmith, who was an old time attorney and had practiced at Troy before he came up here, Frank Moore, and his son Latham Moore, who had graduated just before I did, and Latham had started in with his father. Of course, my C.J. Orland, who later took me in as a partner. There was George Pickett, who had his office up above the Sam's Furniture Store, down toward the Elks Club. There was the man known as Judge Warren Truett. He was very much older. It was an honorary title of judge for Warren Truett, a very well thought of, handsome old gentleman. Then there was also Judge J.H. Forney, who had been a regent of the university and had been its attorney in the early days. His also was an honorary title of judge, because they often would call some venerable old lawyer, well-respected, call him judge. Then there was Al Morgan and Bill Morgan, although William Morgan had just gone to Boise, and he later was elected to the Supreme Court, but his brother Al Morgan was practicing here. There was another old attorney in the back end of the First National Building named H.R. Smith. H.R. Smith was a respected old-timer here who didn't have any trial practice but had some probate practice. And H.R. Smith, I'll always remember, a pleasant old gentleman with a goatee, a staunch Congregational Church member, the father of Harvey Smith. Now, H.R. Smith had been admitted to the bar back before they had the rule that you had to be admitted to the Supreme Court, and he admitted in territorial days by the district court here, and he'd only been admitted to the district court, but he was practicing. Then there was Louis Peterson had been admitted to the bar, but he then was city clerk. There was also Thomas Feeney, who was practicing here, F-E-E-N-E, and Adrian Nelson had been admitted to the bar. He was an early graduate of the university, but Adrian Nelson had been elected probate judge and was probate judge, though he had been practicing here. And there was a Hale Mortgage, who had been a deputy sheriff, I think, was the probate judge when I first came to Moscow. Now, as I said, there were lots of more trial work then, not only prohibition cases, but other cases, very much more trial work. There seemed to be more criminal trial work. Some of the early cases I remember when I first was admitted to the bar was the trial of A.S. Frost for burning down his garage, a trial for arson. That attracted great attention. Frost was charged with burning down his garage for the insurance. He'd heavily insured it. I prosecuted that case in my first year as prosecuting attorney, and it was a long case. It took us 5 or 6 days to trial. We had a jury. The principal witness against Frost was a fellow that the sheriff's force had run down that had said he had been hired by Frost to set the building on fire. And it was a bitterly tried case. The evidence was overwhelming against Frost, although Frost, like a lot of other defendants, was able to bring a lot of witnesses as to his good reputation. But this witness testified positively. He was of Tranchant that had testified he had been hired by Frost to set the building on fire and told how he did it. But in the instruction to the jury, Judge Steele was the judge then, and it's a rule of law that you may not convict a person of any crime on the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice. Uncorroborated means that there must be some independent circumstances apart from the testimony of the accomplice that would tend to connect the defendant with the offense, or with the offense. Well, old Judge Steele, I don't want to do him too much of an injustice, but in the instruction to the jury, he laid down that in great particularity about that the corroboration that was necessary for the testimony of an accomplice, and he laid it and laid stress in that by tone of voice and everything else. I've always suspected he was, well, I hate to say this, but a little tied in with both Oversmith, and they were great friends, and with Frost. But it was as much the inflection as the long and detailed instruction to the jury. Anyway, after a prolonged all-night session, the jury brought in a verdict of acquittal. Now, some of the sheriff's force, and I did, talked to the jurors afterwards, and without exception, they said, well, of course we knew he was guilty. But with the instruction the court gave us, why, we couldn't believe any of his testimony. Why, we couldn't convict him without that. So Frost was acquitted, but that was a major case and a great disappointment to me, but I had better fortune than a good many others. But that attracted a lot of interest here and in the Northwest, the trail of this trial of Frost for arson. And as a matter of fact, Frost never did collect his money for the insurance, but because they refused to pay, and finally Frost abandoned an effort to try to force him to pay, so he got nothing out of it, and Frost left here afterwards. Now another case, mentioned here, and it was about the middle term of when I was prosecuting attorney, was the case of State versus Orr for the attempted robbery of Tommy Matthews. Now, T.D. Matthews was a graduate of the university who had been a track man and was the track coach at the university, I think shortly after I graduated. A very well-respected son of pioneer families. The farm was out here north of Moscow. Now, after he left his coaching at the university, Matthews operated a lunch counter and coffee shop and soft drink place near the entrance to the university and across, Catacornia across from where the LDS building is now. Well, or was, where the LDS building is now. It's near the entrance to the university. I guess that's been torn down now. But it's right almost directly in front of where the front steps of the university is now. And it was a little east of where the Dean J.G. Eldridge house was. Well, now this was a favorite rendezvous of students. And Matthews used to keep it open till midnight at night. It would open in the middle of the morning or early morning. They'd get coffee, students stop and get lunches there. It was a very popular student rendezvous. They usually closed at midnight and go on home. Matthews lived across town, over on the clear across town and over in the area, the general area where Roman Catholic Church stands. It's over in there, and it was his custom each night when he closed up to take his proceeds and get into his car and drive on home at night. Well, this particular night, Matthews closed up his place, took his purse with his cash in it and so on, that his proceeds for the day, went out and got into his car, drove across after midnight across town, and when he had got across Main Street and had gotten up in the neighborhood of where the on First Street to in the neighborhood of where the well, it's the George K. Moody place, where it used to be the parsonage of the Lutheran Church, and up in that corner up here, somebody rose up from behind and hit him on the head. one of these lead, not lead, but shot loaded, leather covered with like blackjack, hit him on the head and knocked him out. And of course the car ran into the curb, and when he came to, the car was wrecked and his purse was gone. Well, we won't go in. There's a long story about how we ran the thing down, but of course here was a very popular campus carrying business, well-known Moscow character, had been robbed, been knocked in the head with a blackjack when he was going home with the proceeds.
Could you say briefly how it was run down? I'd be
well,
very curious.
Of course, there was a young fellow by the name of Orr, Harry Orr, who's not related to any of the Orrs here now, that for several reasons was suspected. He'd been hanging around up there. He'd gone up there and he'd gotten into some minor troubles. And the sheriff's office suspected him and others. He'd been up around this place. And there were some other reasons that caused it, connected him with it. But the principal investigator was our own George K. Moody, old Hap Moody. And somehow old Hap, who had always kind of hung around the campus even those days, could have been interested up there. And he did a lot of questioning and running the thing down. And so old Hap Moody finally, and of course I did a lot of questioning of people for all the incidents of it, and of course talked many times to Matthews, and Matthews did look up and get a hasty look at the man who bent over him and hit him, because the fella coughed and Matthews turned around, heard this noise, and just as he turned around, why, he was hit on the head, but he got a glimpse of the fella, and there's something about him that kind of caused him to, the general idea of the, some of the possible description of about the same size, though it was dark, of this hairy ore, but there was some light from the street light there, but he couldn't identify him, but it was some kind of a hasty, it could have been him. Well, anyway, old Hap Moody went down to the Orr house finally, and shortly after this took place, when he found his suspicions, and he went out in the trash heap, and where the ashes were thrown from the Orr house. And he quietly gathered up those ashes, all the ashes he could find, and then he sifted them carefully. And lo and behold, he sifted out the metal part of a purse, a cash, one of these long leather bank purses that you carry cash and bills in. Then he took that out carefully and shined it up, took it to Matthews, and Matthews, yes, he could identify it. That was his purse. That was the part. Yes, it was a special purse, and it was of a special character, and it came from, I believe, the First Trust Bank, but there were some special markings on it that he could identify it. Well, then there was a lot of other little leads that were worked out into. There was a lot of people in the bank, and there was a lot of interest in this thing. It finally resulted in me filing a criminal charge against Orr for the attempted robbery of and criminal assault on T.D. Matthews. We tried the case, and it was a well-tried case. Orr employed A.L. Morgan, and A.L. Morgan was an able and excellent lawyer. He later became a very good district judge here. And he was an able lawyer, and I respected him. And he defended Orr ably. But finally, the jury, principally upon the testimony of Hap Moody, convicted Harry Orr. Morgan appealed it, or appealed it to the Supreme Court, and that was a hard-fought case in the Supreme Court. The Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General, took a rather dim view of the prosecution, but I secured the permission of the Supreme Court to argue the case, that it was on technical grounds, on some of the technical points of the trial that the appeal was taken. And the Deputy Attorney General argued it on the ground that on technical grounds it ought to be set aside on some of the proceedings in the trial of it. I think we tried it by old Judge Steele, and George Steele by that time was not in his prime, and there were some questions, but I secured the permission, went down, secured the permission of the Supreme Court to argue it on behalf of the state, and I argued it before the Supreme Court myself. I made part of the argument. And fortunately, the Supreme Court said the evidence was so overwhelming, they disregarded some of this other, and Orr was convicted and, of course, was sent to the penitentiary. But it was certainly a case that attracted widespread interest here and throughout the whole Northwest. There we had some reporters here from quite a few places. It was a very interesting case. Now, of course, there are a lot of other cases. I tried lots of other cases, and later went out as I was re-elected in 1932, when the big landslide and Democratic landslide took place, and then I didn't run again. And I had been pressured to run for district judge, but I came out. I had my fill of public office at the time, and I had built up a very substantial practice, so I came out strongly for A.L. Morgan to be the district judge, and he eventually was elected. Maybe Gillis Hodge was the judge when the Orr case was tried, but Gillis Hodge had been appointed after Steele's death, and then he had been elected district judge, Gillis Hodge Hyatt, and then Morgan was elected after Hodge died, and proved a very good district judge here. Then I was elected to the, or I was appointed, no, I was elected to the State Bar Commission, and then as president of the State Bar, and then I was elected to the State Senate, and then World War II came along, and I was called to active duty as a reserve officer in the summer of 1921, and served 5 years, then came back to be elected to Congress, then served 2 years, was defeated in the Democratic landslide of Truman. I had won out in what had been a Democratic district for 13 terms by a 2,000 vote. I was defeated by the same thing 2 years later. Then the next time I decided I'd either get in or out of politics, and I ran for the Senate in the Republican primary, didn't make it, and I was out of politics. Thought I was, went back to my law practice, was enjoying it until I was induced to take the post as general counsel of the Post Office Department, appointed by then President Eisenhower, served as general counsel, that's the chief legal officer of the U.S. Post Office Department, naturally with a big staff of lawyers, in the biggest, the largest government department, except for defense, but of course the Army, Navy, and Air Force, but you see there's 600,000 employees in the Post Office Department. They have an employee in every crossroads in America. That was the biggest civilian legal job in government. From that, I was, after 4 years, appointed as, that is, outside of the Attorney General's office. I'd say that it's the most important department counsel's job, and then from that I was appointed by President Eisenhower to the Interstate Commerce Commission, where I served for 9 years as a member and as chairman, resigning in late 1967 after 9 years to come back to my home here in the Palouse country, which I'd always loved and where I wanted to spend the rest of my days because I like it out here. I had opportunities to stay in Washington, but as my wife said to me, if you take some of these other opportunities you have here, we'll just never get back to Moscow and our home and to the Palouse country and to the Pacific Northwest. Let's go if we're going to go now. So I came back, and I've never regretted it because the people here, that's where my old-time friends are, where the people are industrious, law-abiding, God-fearing, and patriotic, where there's the mountains near and the lakes, the entire opportunity for recreation, and thank God there isn't the racial strife nor the traffic that we find around a big city.